Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show.
It's the Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold. The Early Morning Late Show. Get your day started.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and it is Thursday. And as we are looking at the week, it's been a rough week here, especially in the Twin Cities yesterday with the explosion at Minnehaha Academy. It was a national news story. So if you were watching national news last night, there's a good chance you saw it. And a gas leak created quite an explosion. Two people have died. Many have been injured and hospitalized. And it all took place at a high school here in the Twin Cities area. And just a very, very sad thing. And I'm just wanting to let all of our listeners know in the Faith Radio community that prayers are appreciated for the families, for the community. And I know that because it's a Christian school, God will be honored and glorified in through all of this. And so we're just praying for the people that are suffering and struggling and are waking up today with a brand new reality that they didn't have. You know, you get in your car and you shoot to work and you assume everything's going to be kind of normal. And I think that's one of the things of life that we can never predict is what is going to happen. That's why we get up every day and put our life and our trust into the hands of a loving God who knows everything. And that gives me great comfort. You know, I was looking at some of the other things. This week, we celebrated the 10-year anniversary of the collapse of the 35W bridge here in Minneapolis as well. Again, another big national news story. I think I drove over that bridge the day before it went down, and I had a neighbor who was on that bridge 30 minutes before it went down. So, you know, that's another close-to-home situation, and several people died from that. And then you look at the cost of infrastructure, and I think I can't remember what it was to rebuild that, but it was spendy. And then another bridge just went up. The St. Croix went up, and that bridge just got built to the tune of $648 million. That just opened last night. My friend Johnny McLaughlin drove over it last night, one of the very few people to drive over it. Brand new bridge. That's kind of cool. But there's a lot of money that needs to be spent on bridges and highways and things just to keep America are running and looking good and being safe. So I'm sure that will be discussed in Congress coming up soon. Just the cost. That's going to be one of those bills that Republicans and Democrats will say, yep, 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 need to do it, have to do it. So we have a great second hour coming up, and I can't wait to get started. If you are in a marriage that might have some trouble, sorry, but you can also want to tune in because Dr. Russ Berg is going to be with us. And if you are wanting to know how to respond to a couple that might be struggling, that's a good thing, too, because you can call and ask a question. How to be a first responder to a marriage that's in trouble? And what skills do we need as fellow Christians and church leaders to support marriages in practice as well as in principle? We'll take a short break and be back with Dr. Russ Berg in just a minute. Welcome to the Early Morning Late Show. This is Bill Arnold, where we try to bring faith, hope, and clarity, and I try to bring the faith, and then I sincerely hope my guest answers the phone, because I expect him to bring the clarity. I have on the studio line Paul Kengor, a New York Times bestselling author, and also political science professor at Grove City College, and his latest book, which you must get, is written about the relationship between the Pope and President Reagan. And it's a great book. Paul, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good. Tell our audience again the name of your book, because you say it so well.
Oh, thank you. It's called A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century.
There you go. Which, by the way, is a fantastic book. And thank you for writing it. And thank you for being such a great guest on the show. Now that we've got the news that President Trump has the mooch out, you must have an opinion about that. Please tell us.
Oh, it's just the craziest thing. I'm sorry it was so short-lived.
I mean, me too.
I was ready for, you know, the Sopranos take the West Wing, right? I mean, you know, this was going to be a good 6 months to a year. I guess a year would have been expecting too much. I mean, Trump communication directors are more like 6 months or maybe 6 weeks, right? But I thought, boy, this is going to be, if I get to read stuff like this every day, who needs HBO, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
Just unbelievable. They Scaramucci, he is, I can say this being half Italian, by the way, you know, my late Italian Catholic rosary doing three times a day grandmother gives me kind of a permanent absolution.
It does indeed.
To speak this way, but probably half my relatives on that side are from New York or Long Island, actually Long Island, as they put it. So I know the kind of Anthony Scaramucci's really well, but even then, I don't ever remember my grandmother talking the way that Anthony Scaramucci talked about Steve Bannon, right? I mean, we'd have put grandma in a nut house. We'd have put Nana in a nut house.
Nana in the nut house.
Spoken that way. Yeah, that's the next book right there, Nana in the Nut House. We have to go into fiction next.
Yeah.
But the things that he said. You know, Bill, I was talking to my wife about this yesterday, and we were in a long car ride, she said, "What's the latest that's going on in the White House?" And I told her about the Scaramucci thing, and she said, "You know, Democrats have really foul mouths too, right? I mean, you know." And I said, "Yeah, but you can't imagine what this guy said." And she said, "Oh, I can imagine a lot." I said, I don't know. I don't know if you could have. And it's so bad, right, Bill? But I don't think you could say it.
Oh, no,
I
can't say a thing.
No, it can't be abbreviated even. I mean, it's just really, I'd say beyond profane and explicit. I guess maybe what Donald Trump would have called locker room talk.
Yeah.
During the election campaign. In fact, I was wondering, gee, what's Trump so offended by? All right. I mean, it's probably fit right in. But I guess the answer to the question is that for Trump, this is the wrong kind of communications director, right? I mean, a guy who's coming in to supposedly stop the leaking and who's talking about how he's going to stop the leaking by leaking. So basically, Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker, who then immediately, I mean, who can blame this poor guy? He's not going to, you know, off the record, yeah, right, I'm not going to publish this. And so Lizza published all of this. And among the other things, I mean, Scaramucci, again, it's like right out of The Sopranos, is saying, "I'm going to kill them. I'm going to kill every one of them. I've got their fingerprints. I'm going to kill them." And I mean, you can't make this
you
up.
You can't.
My only regret is that, gee, it didn't last longer than a week.
Oh, my goodness. You know, and there's a part of me that does feel a little sorry for Anthony Scaramucci, only because – you know, Harvard Law School graduate, and all of a sudden now he's got kind of a nice job at the White House. And in the meantime, he's going through a divorce with his wife who's 9 months pregnant. So maybe losing
his... Is she really?
Yeah, she was 9 months pregnant when he was going through the divorce. And, you know, so maybe now losing the job, he can spend more time with his family. Unfortunately, it will be in court.
Wow. No, I didn't know that. And I feel that saddens me as well. You know, my late friend Bill Clark, who works so close to Ronald Reagan, you know, to turn serious about this for a moment, you know, he used to talk about God's wake-up calls. He would say that he would tell me, because I was his biographer, and so he was just telling me the story of his life, and he would say at different times, I'd say, "Wow, Bill, that was really something when that hit." And he'd say, "Wake-up call, Paul." He said, "That was a wake-up call. That was a wake-up." And he always used to tell me, take advantage of moments like this, if you have them in your life, as signals from God to get your act together and to get it together now. And I don't know if Scaramucci thinks that way. I don't know if he's a religious man at all. I mean, I certainly haven't seen any indication of it. But that's too bad. I mean, he's probably he can't be older than 50 or maybe even older than 40.
Yeah.
Does he have any other kids? I mean, his wife is pregnant.
Yeah, his wife was pregnant 9 months when he was going through this divorce, and I think he's got another child. And I don't think that's his first marriage. I don't think.
Oh, yeah. Well, with a guy that talks like that, I mean, I'm not squeaky clean, right? I mean, I wasn't a choir boy growing up myself, but I mean, look, we saw, I guess if maybe there's a kind of a good thing in this, looking at this now again cynically, it's that we saw his true colors. We saw his true character. And I'd much rather know what these people are like before they get into those positions. And in fact, speaking, Bill, of Democrats who speak this way too, or at least kind of this way, well, not exactly this way, but I remember when I was studying Bill and Hillary Clinton, because I wrote a book on the faith of Hillary Clinton, of all things, and I won't say her name, but it was one of the top White House communications people. It was a woman, and they said, well, it was Mandy Grunwald, and they said that, you know, she couldn't speak a sentence without uttering the F word. And I heard that Hillary Clinton's campaign manager in the last campaign, John Podesta, likewise speaks in the same way. But with Scaramucci, it wasn't just the profanity, but the things that he was saying, you know, about Bannon, about Priebus and others. I mean, that's not a guy to come in and calm the waters. I mean, that's a guy to come in and, as he put it, kill people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think now to bring in General John Kelly, that's probably what that White House needs, is a military man.
Yeah, no
right,
kidding.
To come in, and a military man, you know, not a George Patton type. You know, military history people appreciate this. Maybe a George Marshall type.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost how I see John Kelly, a kind of calm, somebody who talks very straight, someone who doesn't curse people up and down, but will come in and say, Mr. Scaramucci, it's time for you to go. And if you don't mind, I am going to escort you out of the White House. and here we go right now.
Yeah.
I've got your arm. Don't panic, sir. Have a good day. And walks him out of the White House. With Scaramucci, maybe F-bombing him all the way out.
Paul, I'm going to take a little break. When I come back, I have a few more questions to ask you about this. I'm talking to Paul Kengor. Take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. Bill Arnold here talking to Paul Kengor, our good friend, and we're talking about really the power of the tongue. And I had a conversation this week with my friend David Wheaton, and we were talking about how damaging the power of the tongue can be. You can be building people up or tearing them down. And we were also talking about the way in which tone and context makes a big difference. And he also brought up the point that it seemed Ronald Reagan had really quite a gift for not only communication, using the right words, but always kind of using the right tone. Talk about that, if you would, Paul.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, you know, Ronald Reagan's key is that he was likable. He was winsome. Ronald Reagan didn't swear. And I mean, the only occasions I found an occasional damn, you know, and even then he would write like D-A, like dash dash,
mm-hmm.
if it was in his writings. And Bill Clark, who I just mentioned, who was his right-hand man, same thing. And in fact, one time I remember, it was Ken DeGraffenried. He worked for the National Security Council under Clark. And he was telling me about something really, really bad that one of the leakers did in the Reagan White House. And I remember him telling me, Bill, he said, that was the only time that I ever heard Judge Clark swear. These men were maybe old school is kind of how we describe it now, but they were gentlemen and they were Christian gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized the importance of controlling your tongue. I mean, it's a lot of people, this will sound maybe stuffy and old fashioned, but it says something about restraint. I think too, I've always told my kids that, you know, it doesn't take, it almost shows a lack of sophistication and creativity if you want to insult somebody to use just a bunch of profane four-letter words, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to, you know, the best writers who've ever lived, you know, somebody like a George Bernard Shaw could write this beautiful prose and even full of insults at times, but you know, elegantly stated. But today, this crass culture that we have, you see it on TV everywhere. You see it on Twitter. You see it on Facebook. It's further fostering this. And again, the president here, President Trump, he's just as guilty of it. And I should add that George W. Bush, who I studied very closely, I did a book on George W. Bush. He very rarely swore. I know people who worked for him. Now, in his earlier days, when he had a drinking problem, he would use saucier language, but he was more dignified about this. So I think there's a real need right now to bring some dignity and decorum back to the White House and the Oval Office. So getting rid of the mooch apparently is an important step to doing that.
Yeah, Paul, what do you know about military people using profanity? Is that something that's fairly common in the military? Do you know?
My students have told me, Bill, some of my Grove City College students, that they've been appalled at what they've seen in the military. And I remember one of them, his name was Dylan. He became a JAG, a Judge Advocate General in the military. And he was really dismayed at, he had an image of the military, kind of brought up in a homeschooled Christian family from the Midwest. And he was really appalled at some of what he saw. And it also very, 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 very high rates of divorce and infidelity that he saw among junior people in the military. He told me he was depressed over that. It wasn't what he expected. But I think the military has been better than the culture at large in that regard. This isn't just in a time of war when you're storming the beaches of Normandy, saving Private Ryan, and you can understand guys getting a little hot tempered,
right?
And losing control of their tongue a little bit, but just sort of in everyday conversation. So maybe some people think I'm being a stuffy professor type here, but I really would love to see a return to the days of people being more civil in their discourse. And you mentioned too, Bill, the power of silence. That's forgotten.
Isn't it though?
It really is. Silence in terms of contemplation, in terms of turning off the electronics sometimes, and also sometimes when somebody says something that angers you, you don't have to react immediately. We react immediately by typing something, which is even worse. But if you're face to face with it, you don't have to blurt something out. Sometimes it's better just to walk away and bite your tongue and reply later in a way that isn't going to be as hurtful or damaging. But we seem to have lost that in the culture.
And probably the internet has something to do with it, because we can retaliate so quickly from the privacy of our bunkers in front of our laptops. If it meant that you had to get out a letter, a piece of paper, and write a letter and put a stamp on it and find the guy's address and then put it in the mail, you may not do it. So I think
that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Think about that. In the old days, you would write a letter in response.
Yeah.
Then you put it on your dining room table and then it would sit there overnight.
I know.
And you'd be able to literally sleep on it.
I know.
And then the next day you wouldn't have to put it in the mail. Now you just respond, you type it up immediately. You hit the send button. It's like a verbal cruise missile. Right.
Oh, exactly.
And I've had occasions where I've done that and I've regretted it. My son just last week got an email from somebody. He started responding. I said, Mitch, as far as he knows, you might not even get this for 2 days. You don't need to respond to this right now. So give it an hour even. Just think. Don't just type and then hit send. And fortunately, he waited, and then I think he sent something that was not as edgy as would have been his impulsive. That maybe that's another word here. The impulsiveness that we're seeing from the president, that's how he is. That's his nature. And certainly from Scaramucci, you can't have that from people running the United States of America.
Yeah, for sure. I've often said that, whenever you send an email, you should reread it before you send it and consider taking out your last sentence.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Yeah, edit it. Go back through it and read it 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
And because people don't always expect an immediate response because they don't know if you've seen it right away. That's been lost. And of course now with Twitter, I don't use Twitter, but is it 40 characters or something like that? And then we also have text messages and people spelling words U-Y-O-U with just a U and abbreviate everything and using no periods and now using phrases like OMG of all things and right and on and on and on. It is there's so many nice things about modern technology, but I often think that there are many more worse things about modern technology.
Yeah. Paul, I love talking to you, and I so appreciate when you come on the show. I know that your recent book, A Pope and a President, Pope John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century is a big hit, and I love the book, and I appreciate you being a guest on the show. You can come on anytime you want.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. Maybe next time I'll bring on my Uncle Bruno and my cousin Dino.
I love it.
And we'll have a conversation. We'll pick up our conversation about the mooch.
Yeah, I'd love to meet those guys over there. You know what I'm talking about?
Right. You got it.
All righty, Paulie.
You got it.
I'll talk to you next time. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Yep. We'll take a short break and be right back with more of the Early Morning Late Show in just a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour. Keeping your heart and mind on the joy of the Lord will strengthen you and give you energy to be more productive. Here's Dr. Linda Mintel.
If we pursue that joy of the Lord that transcends our circumstances, the joy of the Lord is based on God's complete and unconditional love for you. It doesn't change. It never changes. And the circumstances change. Other things in our life change. But if we put our eyes on the Lord and really understand that He loves us and we rejoice in the reality of His deep and His very reliable love for us, that's always available to us, always. And that should strengthen us, and that should give us the ability then to have some energy to go forward to the day and be more productive.
That was Dr. Linda Mintel. That's our Dr. Linda Mintel. And you can hear that interview in its entirety on myfaithradio.com. Go to the website, type in Dr. Linda Mintel, or type in Habits, Highly Productive People. All right, coming up next, Russ Berg, Hope for the Hurting Home. If you have a difficult, troubled marriage, or maybe you're at a stage where you can be a first responder to someone you know and love who is struggling, get the phones ready because you can call with questions, 877-933-2484. Be back in just a minute with Dr. Russ Berg.
Recently, I asked parents on my Facebook page to answer a tough question. If you could do it all over again, what would you do differently? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. To be honest, I was half expecting people to just quote some of my better-known parenting tips. But the moms and dads who responded ended up giving some really good, thoughtful answers. Things like, I'd worry less, I'd spend more time together as a family, and I'd give more hugs and kisses, even if they made a fuss. They all sound like such little things, don't they? But hindsight is always 20/20, and don't look back with any regret. Because to your son or daughter, the little things are what really count.
Mark Gregston has prepared a brand new resource to help parents make the most of their teens' extra time during summer vacation. Download your free copy online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Good morning. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. I think everybody has, at some point, a fairly significant struggle with their marriage, whether it's a season or a long season. But Dr. Russ Berg has a ministry called HopeForTheHurtingHome.com, and he's been married to his high school sweetie, Melody, for 41 years. He was a pastor for 36 years, and now he really wants to help people with marriages that are in trouble. If you have one today or you want to ask Russ a question, give us a call, 1-877-933-2484, or you can email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. Russ, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Bill. Thanks. You forgot I've been married 41 years. Melody said it's the 30 happiest years of her life. I forgot to put that on the bio.
So every married couple has got their season of difficulty. I had a listener today write in and say, in anticipation of you being on the air, that, you know, she's in a period where a lot of her friends have marriages now in about their 20th year. and they have expectations that are just not really maybe being met. It's like a dream. Maybe if you've had a dream that you would have a long career that maybe didn't come to fruition. Maybe
sure.
The kids didn't turn out the way you hoped. Maybe financially you're not where you think you'd want to be or you thought you'd be. Or maybe the relationship just isn't as fulfilling as you would expect after such a long investment in a relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think sometimes we need to remember that the person we're married to today is not the person we married. That we change as people. I think a lot of times, too, the dreams that we have are sometimes more influenced by our own needs and the cultural voices that, everybody ought to be married to a 10 or at least a solid 8.9. And when we kind of fall below that, we can begin to focus on the 10 or 15% in our relationship that maybe has fallen short and lose sight of the fact that during that investment of years and time and energy and memories and oftentimes children, the 85% is really worth living for and worth protecting. But we can become, really focused on the negative or the part that's not what we had hoped for. Sometimes, too, you need to grieve the death of a dream for you to enter into a new season of marriage where you are right now, where you and your spouse are right now.
Russ, say more about that, about the death of a dream.
Paul Tripp wrote a book that really impacted me. I've got the title wrong, but it's something like God's Grace in Midlife. And there's a chapter in there, and this particularly hit me the season I was in, where he said sometimes we realize that more of our life is in the rearview mirror than ahead of us. And we feel like we're in the autumn of our life, standing in a pile of leaves of regret with no dream for the future. And his counsel and advice was, we get to a place in our life where, let's say Mel and I have, we've experienced this at different times. So, after being married, actually it's going to be 43 years in October, so the bio's a little old. We realize there are things that we are not going to accomplish or not going to experience, either because of life season, of finances, health, and that we need to be able to grieve those things that are not going to happen in order for us to embrace what does God want us to experience together as a couple for the next season of marriage that's ahead of us, for the next 10 or 12 years. Oftentimes I think people end up wasting years of their life hoping and praying and dreaming of a life they're never going to have, and they let slip through their hands. The great country western theologian Eddie Rabbit had that song, What's Forever For, a number of years ago. It says, I see love-hungry people trying their best to survive. And right there in their hands is a dying romance, and they're not even trying to keep it alive. We become focused on the dream we wanted to have or the marriage we thought we deserve rather than really cultivating and working at the marriage that God's given to us.
Very interesting, Russ. So talk about how expectations, how they're formed and what happens to them and what's worth going for and then what you have to let go of.
Sure. There's a little bit different rabbit trail, but this is really interesting to me because I've been thinking a lot about it. Andy Stanley has a video called iMarriage. It's on YouTube. People can see it. It's a great three-part series. But in there, he talks about how all of us come into marriage with desires. We can't help it. This is we're wired this way. Our first marriages, we've never done this before. All we have are our dreams. But our desires about marriage are shaped by two very powerful things. One, how has God wired us? So our personalities determine a lot of this. But secondly, they're shaped by how we were raised, how we saw marriage being lived out, either in a healthy way or in an unhealthy way. And when desires are unmet, they become expectations. And we start hearing phrases like, I just thought you knew this was what a wife should do. This is what a husband ought to be doing. When expectations are unmet, they morph into demands. And so we start getting on each other's back instead of on each other's team. When demands are unmet in seasons of marriage, they become ultimatums. I won't live with a person who does this. And we begin to then create that bottom line thing, I can't live with this, and then we fill in the blank.
This is really interesting, Ross. I also want to take a very short break to allow listeners, if they'd like to call in and ask a question to Dr. Russ Berg, to do so at 1-877-933-2484. You can also email me, bill@myfaithradio.com, if you'd like to ask your question in the form of an email, because you don't want to come on the air. I'll ask it for you. How's that? It's 14 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Russ Berg from Hope for the Hurting Home. Minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here. I'm talking to Dr. Russ Berg from Hope for the Hurting Home. That's hopeforthehurtinghome.com if you want to learn a little bit more about that. We're talking about marriages that can and be in trouble, that are in trouble, and also how you can be a first responder for marriages that are in trouble. You want to show up on the scene. What's the best thing to do? Russ, a listener wrote in and said, what should I do when a spouse is verbally abusive? How to deal with a spouse's chronic anger?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you shot me. And maybe this is a second. It's a very, very common thing, so this could have been a second thing that got sent in. But so I did a little bit of thinking about this last night. verbal abuse and chronic anger. I want to be really careful here because there's two sides of the coin. One and probably two directions we can go in that can lead to extremes that aren't helpful. One is we can deny that something is as bad as it is, something that really needs help, it really needs attention. And these are what we call hard reasons for marital distress. They almost all begin with the letter A. Abuse, abandonment, addictions, adultery. Those are things that no one should have to live with. They're not immediate reasons for divorce, but what they do indicate is a hard reason means that this marital distress, the source of it, is residing in the behavior of one person. There may be reasons why it's easy. So, you know, for example, if I'm struggling with an addiction, there may be factors in our home that enable my addiction or make it easier. But that addiction is always my choice. It's never Melody's fault that I make unhealthy choices or that I'm chronically angry. The other end of the coin, though, is that we are a society of labels. We want to fix things. We want to understand things. We don't like ambiguity. And so if we can put a label on a problem or a person, oftentimes it can give us an excuse for not examining our contributions to why that might be so. So I just came up with a couple things. I don't know if these are helpful, but kind of a combination of things that either I've been working with people on or reading about. You know, one, I think we need loving boundaries. We need fences, not walls. And there's, you know, Towns has written a lot about, there's a lot of good books on Cloud and Towns on their books on boundaries. Mm-hmm. But I think I've noticed a lot of people who have read those books, and for them, boundaries are walls. They are de facto things that happen in the relationship that are not going to let you get through, rather than fences that delineate where does my responsibility stop and yours start. Sometimes, too, we need to go back to Jim Dobson's concept of tough love. We need to make sure that we're not enabling chronic behavior, but we're also not setting up entrapment for chronic behavior. Sometimes we can get into a cycle where we believe our spouse cannot change, and so either intentionally or unintentionally, we set up buttons that we push that kind of reinforce the narrative that, see, my spouse is, and then we fill in the blank.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second thing I would encourage people to do is just with the loving boundaries, I just want to go back to that for a second. We need to take seriously any kind of behavior that puts at risk a family's you know, physical or emotional safety. And there are, we need to take that very seriously. We're not encouraging people to stay in destructive or harmful relationships. But having said that, I think both parties, and especially the person that's maybe struggling with the spouse that has a chronic issue, is we need to have honest ownership of what do I contribute. And let me give you an example. We tell people there's good math to relationships, and we tell them to remember the numbers 2 and 4. I'm responsible to people to love them, serve them, sacrifice for them, be there for them, but I'm not responsible for them. God's responsible ultimately for them, and they're ultimately responsible for their own behavior. So there are times when, and I've seen this in husbands and wives, where a person is described as having chronic anger. It could be childhood issues. It could be issues in the dynamic of the marriage where it's this thing that we call pursuer-distancer. You know, we call it the woodpecker and the turtle. One person likes flight, and the other person likes to fight. And so sometimes the person who's been pecking, I need a response. We're going to have this argument. Just talk to me. Sometimes they actually encourage, by their behavior, by their personality type, they actually encourage the kind of angry response that's just a turtle saying, leave me alone. And you do need professional help for that, because there's two sets of contributions to that. There are never excuses for destructive behavior, but there are really gifted counselors that can help you understand the dynamics and begin to change the dance a little bit at a time. I think third thing, I think for people who are in these really, really painful relationships, ask God for compassion and not contempt. Most of us who work with people who are struggling we're familiar with the phrase, hurt people hurt people. And I've run into many spouses where, unfortunately, the one spouse is the recipient of the chronic verbal abuse or chronic anger, but they have no clue what tools were put in or left out of the toolbox of their spouse when they married them. They're oftentimes not aware of their spouse's narrative of what's going on at work, things that might be contributing because of a previous marriage. And these are not excuses, but they're really important windows of empathy that I have found when a spouse that's married to someone who's struggling with one of these hard reasons has more compassion than contempt. Oftentimes, that spouse that needs professional help is more willing to go because they don't feel the rejection or the condemnation of their spouse that doesn't have the issue. Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes a ton of sense.
And then I think another thing I wrote down here, I give most of the clients that I work with, I give them a picture of, it's actually taken out of Luke 15, Rembrandt's Return of the Prodigal. It's a very famous painting. Mm-hmm. And I took it off the internet, and someone said you can't get in trouble if you take it off the internet. But if it's on the internet, that might not be true. But we have them printed off, and it's a very famous painting, and it has all the characters of Luke 15, the father, and the father's holding the prodigal who's returned, and then there's the older brother standing off to the side, and we have people put this on their, we have them printed off, put on the refrigerator, and ask themselves three questions when they walk by it. One, am I more like the father today giving grace? Am I more like the prodigal who screwed up, who's in need of grace, in need of forgiveness? Or am I more like the older brother who's withholding grace?
Wow. Russ, it's such a delight to have you on the show, and I do want to have you back. This conversation must continue. There's other callers that would like to get on, so maybe we can do this again soon.
Love to do that. And sorry about the mix-up today.
No problem, Russ. Thanks.
You spoke to me on earlier.
Thanks so much. Have a great day. It's 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and then wrap up the show. Have a great day, everybody. You know, it says in 1 Samuel chapter 16, people look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. How nice is that? Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show. Connecting.